Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namotasa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I thought I'd talk a little bit about a kind of current debate that is going on within the Buddhist circles, modern Buddhist circles, so to speak. Anyway, some people would believe that the ultimate state, the state of enlightenment, is one in which one has no defilements in the mind, one has no stuff coming up, so to speak, it's all gone. There's no lust or desire, for example, coming up. That one's gone from the mind. And the other opinion would be that if this is a natural thing to arise, lust, for example, a natural thing to arise, and that if one doesn't follow this, but just sees this natural state arise and cease, this is already the ultimate state. You know, that one can, these things can arise, natural things can arise and cease in the mind. There's no problem with that. That here we are, human beings with, you know, biological bodies, and of course these things are going to arise naturally enough. Why make a problem out of it? You know, somebody doesn't have these things coming up, then you should worry about it. Oh, you're not very natural, is it? You know, must be suppressing it. You know, there's one psychological views around these things. So kind of trusting one over the other. With all the unfortunate scandals within the church, Catholic Church, that there's still, you know, celibacy was still alive in practice of Catholicism. People not trusting this so much either, which is a terrible shame. I think, well, maybe better to have a married priest than one who ends up messing around. After all, these things are natural enough and harmless enough, and this is true. It's true. And then it's better to have somebody who's married, because then you're not going to be causing any problem. Their desire is looked after. It's going to be there, so better to look after it than to deny it and push it away or suppress it. And it become dangerous and be big problems. It's a kind of debate that can go on. In Buddhist practice, then, the practice of celibacy, then, is considered a central one and related to the realization of the Dhamma, high Dhamma. So it's not just an add-on or a state of purity in itself. You know, not a more pure person because you refrain from sexual activity doesn't make you a pure person. It's the change in the perception of the body that is possible for somebody who lives a celibate life that can lead to purity. Not everyone gets there, not everyone practices this, who's a monk or a nun. But that has the potential to purify the mind, to see the body in a different way, non-sensual way. So this is the way in which these things don't arise, is not through suppression or denial or whatever those things mean. Never sure about these terms, really. They are the crude terms, how well they fit the Buddhist teaching or my experience of the mind. But even if this was, you know, you think, well, you could do it like this. Yes, you could. I guess in some way you could try to ignore your sexual urge, and maybe this wouldn't work. Buddha says this doesn't work. And ignore these things. becoming more and more aware of them is the way of the practitioner, not ignoring or trying to push these things away, or just try to be pure. Yeah, try to be, just think that purity just lies just in abstinence. This can, fail us. It's just through doing this through willpower, then our willpower can fail us. So it's really through not wanting these things, not through denying these things to ourselves, that is the spiritual path, but not wanting these things. So there can be a mistake then on enlightenment is. You think that it's free of lust. And maybe it's free of lust in a way that we don't really understand. We can be free of lust if we're interested in something else or whatever. But if you see the body in a completely different light, a different way, then the mind can be naturally free of it in that way. Got a radical way. This would be a radical thing, because we can associate sexuality, sensuality with what it really is to be a human being. And yes, we can think it's hardwired into the system, biologically hardwired in, and yet it operates through perception. So it's not possible to affect the perceptual process and get beyond it, and then to realize that, well, we're not essentially sexual, sensual beings, we're spiritual beings. Which have these sexual, sensual tendencies, which can be to our benefit or to our harm. But it's not essentially, this isn't our sensual nature. And we can take this to get to be so, and we can discover that this is not the case, and this is a very radical thing. This is an existential shift. And we see ourselves not really previously seeing ourselves like animals in a way that, we're essentially here to reproduce and survive, and same as an animal. If we raise up sexuality and sensuality the highest, then this is the highest thing for the animal species too, isn't it? To reproduce, most important, very important drive, strong, very strong drive, strongest drive. So in getting beyond this, then we can really, really completely see ourselves in a completely new light. A spiritual being trying to make the best of a human life, rather than a human being trying to be more spiritual. In that way, that's the healthy way. We're trying willfully to be good and be more spiritual, and this resolve can let us down, go wrong. And we can ask ourselves, well, at the end of the day, then is this, these desires, are they pleasant? Are the desire in itself, is it pleasant? Or the feelings associated with the gratification of it, but what about the desire itself? Is that pleasant, or is it suffering to have desire? Do we really satiate that desire through our sexuality? Can that be satiated, or is it more the case that the more we get, the more we want? It's insatiable, this kind of desire. Find this kind of thing out for ourselves, don't have to take anyone else's word for it. We say, it's not maybe coarsely insatiable, but is it still addictive? Just look at that, the state of desire. If we enter into this whole world, and then we're entering into a world of desire, then maybe there's a world that has no desire. What's no desire like? Do we know that? Have we ever seen it? And maybe it's not just, not wanting something, just a kind of dull state oh, I don't really want it anymore. Maybe not like that. Maybe it's a much more pleasant state, and the people who've got to these kind of states will tell you how joyous and with a great sense of freedom and liberation this kind of freedom represents. Freedom from desire. It's kind of the ultimate freedom, or in a way the only freedom. Freedom from desire. So I think that freedom is about following our desires, the freedom to follow our desires, and yet they trap us. Real freedom is freedom from desire. But we don't have to theorise like this, we just look in our own experience and say, well, is there suffering there in these desires? So would it be more pleasant not to have desire? These desires are suffering. And my mind is so, well, if it's a higher state and not a more pleasant state not to have desire. And you can see that if people seem to have attained to these kinds of states, then this would seem higher and deeper. A state in which one is just watching one's desire, watching one's suffering arising and ceasing, doesn't mean that one's free of it and one lacks it. One may be relatively detached from it, not reacting to it, able to endure it, and sometimes for very good reason. I can endure these things in order to serve mankind. The great vision of the Bodhisattva, who's willing to suffer this kind of desire in order to be more open to help others, or available to help others, because it can be a very beautiful thing. But it can go wrong as well, can't it? A beautiful intention to suffer these things and to help lead others towards a better life and towards enlightenment, to postpone one's own enlightenment for the sake of others is perhaps a beautiful thing. And yet be careful that it can go wrong and the boundary becomes less clear. You start to harbour the passions in our minds, and then where is this going to be taking us? If we end up living a lie, couldn't we? If we're preaching desirelessness, and then we're harbouring the desire in our mind in some way or other. And if we recognise that there's a way to be free of it, because these things do operate through perception. You think of homosexuality and how a homosexual man will perceive another man's body is different from how a heterosexual man will perceive another man's body. Perceptions are not a fixed thing. Urges are not a fixed thing. Different things turn the different people on, isn't it? Different perceptions. So how is that? You see the influence of perception to trigger these things. Buddhist terms to say that there's not such a thing as sexual energy so much as there's a life energy that will tend to go in the direction of sexuality. So it's not that one loses one's energy or vitality through the abstinence of sexual activity. That's cool. Clearly not the case. You see how vital and how much energy can actually come about through celibacy. One of the benefits can be one of the benefits of that energy, peacefulness and simplicity. It's that kind of life, disentanglement. As well as a realization. From committing either temporarily or longer term to celibacy. as a skillful means, not as a not to be better or right or pure in itself, but so that we can take another look, a different look at the body, our relationship to the body. So we have to be careful, I think, in the modern age, where sometimes it can be hard to find the conditions to practice it very deeply and become enlightened. In a difficult age to become enlightened, I think this is probably a truth, and it's not easy these days. In the modern world, temptation is everywhere. It's hard to get away from with all the technology and so on. The Thai forest tradition is very worried about the computer, influx of computers and the internet and so on. It's becoming a difficult age to escape temptation. I think it's probably true, but the danger is then that we'll just lower the goal and say, oh well, so we'll just redefine enlightenment as something that's a less high state or a less pleasant one. It's the observation of suffering, being aware of suffering rather than actually escaping it. We say, well, here you can try and fudge it and say, well, to me it's a fudge anyway. I mean, you can correct me on this. This is a very live debate, very willing to listen. To me, these things have never arisen in the mind without there being an element of suffering. So it's hard for me to see how just watching these states arise and cease is an escape from suffering. We can say, well, these things are not me and I'm not suffering. But to me, that still hurts. Whether I think I have this sense, well, maybe I'm not suffering anymore, I'm detached from these things, just watching these things. But to me it also can be a danger there of just becoming an observer of the internal world, because these things have, an internal world after all has messages for us, important messages, important lessons. What else do we have as a source of wisdom and information? We're just watching these things arise and cease, and oh well, there we are, it's the mind arising and ceasing. Then where's our source of wisdom in the world? You say, well, this is a way of seeing which has wisdom to it. Maybe that's right, it has wisdom to it. Lack of involvement in things that are ultimately suffering, maybe that has wisdom to it, but if there's a higher state, then it's good to know about that. Even if it's difficult for us to find the conditions to practice in a way that can take us there, then we've still not sold ourselves short. We think, well, I can practice as a bodhisattva this life and make good karma this life for the next life, and maybe next life I can find better conditions. This is the attitude of a really somebody with a lot of faith. So as a obviously there's a Theravadan perspective there, isn't there? I would have, wouldn't I, if I'm a Theravadan monk? But I'm not. I hope that I'm not arguing with the other. I have a great admiration and respect for the Bodhisattva ideal. The whole vehicle would be difficult to bump along without it. Offer that one for your reflection.